expenditures, second, and then transportation also received some significant funding, and they have shown great deals of expenditures as well, with education coming in for it. Some key components that led to our ability to be very transparent about the use of ERA funding were the fact that initially we right away started out with segregating the funds in our statewide accounting system so that they could easily be identified as a separate federal funding source, even though many of the programs in ERA were existing federal programs and were dollars to supplement those existing programs. All ERA funds are accounted for separately in MAPS. In addition, the Act in and of itself required significant reporting that is beyond anything that's been required by any other federal program before. And that is commonly referred to as the Section 1512 report. That's the section within the Act that requires the quarterly reporting. There are many programs then for which organizations that receive ERA funds are required on a quarterly basis to submit a detailed report to the federal government. In addition to that report, we early on identified that the legislature and the public were interested in additional information beyond the information that would be included in the federal report. And so we designed a MMB project level detail report that allows folks to know down to the project level what's happening, how much has been awarded, what's a description of the project, what are the jobs that that project is reporting, funding with ERA funds, and so forth. We also built on existing systems that were in place, like the Office of Grants Management has a centralized posting for grant opportunities in Minnesota. So we partnered with those types of existing websites that were in place and linked to them from our recovery site so that our site could be a window into all of the activities associated with ERA. An additional component that the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board is extremely concerned about is the ability for the public to know how to easily report fraud, waste, and abuse. And so as I demonstrate our website, you'll see right on our front page where we have a link that links right into the federal government standard for reporting any suspicious cases for anyone in the public who's interested in wanting to notify them of something that may not be appropriate with the federal government. The reporting timelines are standardized. There are a couple timelines that are actually in the federal law for recipients to report information on. Day one after the reporting quarter ends is when the centralized system that's been developed by the federal government, called federalreporting.gov, opens up for recipients to start putting data into that system. Day 10, this is a day that is actually specified in the federal law, is the date by which recipients must have their preliminary information in the system. So it's 10 days, which is very unique. Days 11 through day 21 after the reporting period ends then is for a recipient to go in and clean up any data, or if there's anything that they missed in their information, it's a data quality review time period. And then days 22 through 29 are when the federal agencies are in the system and taking a look at the data, identifying any questions they have, any inconsistencies they may be seeing, and so forth. And then day 30 is also a day that is in the Act, and that is the day 30 days after the end of the reporting quarter, the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board is required to publish the data publicly.
So you're saying that all these things are actually in the Act, they're not regulations that were developed later?
Madam Chair, the two dates that are in the Act are day 10 for the initial reporting and then day 30. Okay. The Office of Management and Budget released guidance in June of last year, and that's where they identified the days 11 through 21 and the days 22 through 29. Okay. So they put some additional parameters around what was specified in the federal law.
Okay. You know, we actually have a lot of people here, almost complete. We certainly have a quorum, so I think this is a good time to stop for a minute because we have a. Where did our page go? Okay. We do have a new page, and would you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Colin Furness. I am originally from Owatonna, and Representative Kath is actually my teacher. I just
so if you're no good, we get to blame him, and if you're terrific, we get to thank him.
I just graduated from the University of Iowa with a BA in History and Political Science. I'm looking forward to working with you all.
Okay, and Luke Kuhl, we remember from the past, but we do have a new Republican research assistant. So
yes, I'm House researcher. My name is Margaret Martin for the session, and I have a PhD from the University of Michigan and an MA from London School of Economics, and I've been working in think tanks up until now, and this is my first stint working for government, and I live in North Minneapolis.
Okay, great. Okay, and we have, you want to do the minutes, Seth? Okay, you have in your folder, you have, how many? Oh, okay. We have a whole set of minutes, the minutes of 4:15, 4:21, 5:11, and 7:09. And Representative Kath moves adoption of all of the minutes all at once. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, minutes are adopted. And we can now go on with the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first federal reporting period then ended on September 30th of 2009. The act was passed in February, but the first reporting period reflects more than a quarter. Beginning after September 30th, then recipients are required to report on a quarterly basis. So on October 10th, state agencies in Minnesota were required to submit their first reports through the centralized federal reporting system that was created. The 10th fell on a Saturday, a bit of notice is that the 10th day after the reporting quarter ends all this year is always on a weekend. It's either a Saturday or a Sunday, unfortunately. So the 10th day fell on a Saturday, and then on Monday, October 12th, MMB made available to the public a comprehensive spreadsheet that had all of the data. So for the data crunchers, that became available to them almost immediately. Not all programs are subject to the Section 1512 reporting, but we felt it was really important that the public get a full view of the impact of the stimulus package in Minnesota. And so we included additional programs like the increased FMAP, the unemployment insurance, the supplemental nutrition assistance program. So big funding items that weren't subject to 1512 reporting but represented big dollar amounts in Minnesota. We included information on those programs in addition to those that are required to report under Section 1512. On October 30th, then, MMB on the recovery.mn site, we published the final data. And then shortly after that, 5 days after that, we were able to post on our website the recovery map, which you'll see is a result of a partnership that we entered into with MnGeo at the Department of Administration. Then on November 20th, we also produced an additional component on our website that's called interactive reports, and I will demo those for you so that you can see what we mean by interactive reports that are available. Then the second reporting quarter ended on December 31st, and because we wanted to make sure all of our data was updated at the same time, we chose to, rather than sporadically release information, to update all the data sets on our website at one time. And so on February 5th, last Friday, we released the updated map, the updated database, and the updated interactive reports. So as Representative Kahn mentioned, and as I mentioned early on, we were recognized for our transparency efforts and the fact that we were able to quickly get information out to the public about the implementation of the Recovery Act in Minnesota. Some of the things that led to our success was that there was a great deal of prioritization of the Recovery Act by the administration, by state agencies. The legislature was very interested in it. So it became a very high priority item for state agencies to administer this program quickly, to be transparent about the spending. Also, with the president's overview and the expectation by the administration and the recovery board that oversees the implementation of the Recovery Act, transparency was evident from the get-go. There was an expectation out there that states would be transparent and that the federal government would be transparent. The fact that the federal government identified standard data sets across all federal awards and developed a centralized federal reporting system, it allowed us to look at data in a different way than we've been able to in the past, in that we could look at things across programs like how many jobs were created or retained, how much spending was there infrastructure investment, things like that. So we haven't had that kind of standardization that the federal government led with ERA. Also, we were able to build upon existing state systems. The Office of Enterprise Technology has a staff augmentation process in which we were able to quickly get someone on staff for a relatively low cost to take all the hundreds of reports that we were getting from the state agencies and allow them to be compiled into one comprehensive database and allow us to transfer that data into a system that would be needed for MnGeo to do the mapping functions that are available on our map. I mentioned our work with MnGeo. We were able to enter into an interagency agreement. They were able to access a software program that other states were using and that other states were being recognized for in terms of mapping where the dollars were going, and so that was a big success for us as well. We did face many challenges, though, with this. These reporting timelines are quicker than anything we've ever seen before with federal funds. Typically, federal funds allow at least 30 days after the end of the reporting quarter, in some cases up to 90 days after the end of the reporting quarter to be submitting reports. The 10-day window, I want to note for you that while it's not just the state agency having to compile information that they may have within that 10 days, many of the state agencies are administering programs that involve many grants to local entities, and so they have to get all the data from their local entities within that 10 days in order to be able to turn around and report it on the federal system. Also, the fact that we had a lot of momentum around ERA allowed us to collect additional information, but it was also a little bit of a barrier. We were asking state agencies to provide us with more information than the federal act was requiring. We actually had to ask of each state agency that they do a separate report to us so that we could use that information and get it available on the website. And then with the first reporting period, the Office of Management and Budget came out with overarching guidance in June of last year. And then they allowed each federal agency to supplement the guidance that they had issued. And in many cases, the federal agency guidance conflicted with the guidance that had been issued by the Federal Office of Management and Budget. And so that provided some inconsistencies in terms of how jobs were reported, things of that nature. And it was challenging from MMB's perspective to work across all of those different federal agencies and support the state agencies when all of the federal agencies may have been saying slightly different things. And then we also learned that not all information is useful on a map. One of the things that one of the big highlights initially was to map the information. But when you have a project that might be statewide in nature or have a statewide impact, it's very challenging to put that on a map. And so that's what led to our development of the interactive reports. We found that information in multiple formats was what the public was interested in. A primary question that we are often asked is, can these transparency efforts be transferred to other areas, other programs, other areas of the budget, and so forth? And in many cases, it is possible, but it does take some careful planning and assessment and time and resources. States that were leading the way, I mentioned that Good Jobs First ranked states last summer, so we were able to right away have a benchmark to work towards. We were able to look towards other states that had ranked high on their transparency efforts and see what tools they were using, what types of things they had on their websites. That gave us something to build from. We also knew right away that the expectation on ERA was spending and jobs. People wanted to know that. Where was this money going and what was the job impact of the ERA funds? The legislature also provided some additional funds to MMB to support some additional staffing, to support our interagency agreement with MnGeo. I mentioned the Office of Enterprise Technology staff augmentation. So we had additional resources to bring in the tools we needed right away to meet the transparency expectations. Another piece to keep in mind when thinking about transferring this to other areas is that currently state data exists in many formats. As I mentioned, the federal standardization about what recipients would report and the centralized system for reporting that information led to our ability to show a comprehensive picture of what was happening with the stimulus dollars in our state. In January, then, the Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board, along with the Federal Office of Management and Budget, decided that they needed some consistency around the jobs reporting in particular. And they issued guidance very late in the game for the recipients. On December 18th, they came out with new guidance about the jobs data. They indicated at that time that jobs would be reported quarterly rather than cumulative. All of the other data elements in the Recovery Act, the Section 1512 reports, are a cumulative reflection of what's happened with the stimulus package. So if you look at how much has been spent, for example, that's cumulative. That's how much has been spent since the act was first passed. But if you look at the jobs data, what that is that's reflective of the quarter only. So it reflects October 1st through December 31st, 2009. And they also indicated that rather than making a judgment about whether or not a job was created or retained, recipients would be required to report FTE counts for any position that's funded with Recovery Act dollars. So the salaries or wages being funded with Recovery Act dollars are what is used to develop the FTE calculation and report to the federal government. Due to this late issuance of guidance, which, as I mentioned earlier, required then the state agencies to go out to all of their subrecipients and inform them about the changes in the job calculations and collect additional information from their subrecipients, the Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Board extended the deadline. I had mentioned earlier that in the Act, the 10th is the designated deadline. What they did is they extended it 5 days. And so they initially extended it through January 15th, allowing for 5 additional days to get the reports in. Then on the 15th, they decided to extend it again. All of the state agencies in Minnesota met the first deadline. So we met the deadline of January 15th for getting our initial reports in. The final data then was published on January 30th on the recovery.gov site, which shows a comprehensive picture of what's happening in the nation. That site includes information on not only state agency administered programs, but funding that might go directly from the federal government to a local entity here. The recovery.min site, the site that Minnesota Management and Budget is overseeing, is just on state agency administered programs. The Recovery Board then, some of you may be familiar with the congressional district controversy that occurred with the first reporting period. They identified what they called phantom congressional districts. And the system was scheduled to be locked down after the 30th, and there was no ability to make changes in the federal reporting system. They decided that that was not a good way to go, that if there was information in that system that was incorrect, they should allow recipients to go in and correct that information. So what the Recovery Board is doing is they're allowing recipients to go in on an ongoing basis and update their information, and then the website that the federal government oversees is republished every 2 weeks. So changes to the jobs reporting, to the guidance that was issued, it doesn't allow for us to make an apples-to-apples comparison of what state agencies reported in the first quarter versus what they reported in the second quarter. It also indicates FTEs, so it's not a headcount of how many people were employed because of the Recovery Act, but what it does is it converts hours worked into an FTE calculation. What we saw in Minnesota for state agency-administered programs was that 10,303 FTEs were funded during the period of October 1st through December 31st, 2009, with Recovery Act dollars. The majority of the jobs are in the education field, and this seems to be consistent nationwide. This is where the majority of jobs are being counted. Part of that has to do with the state fiscal stabilization fund dollars that are going to school districts, and they're being used to cover salaries and wages of employees within school districts. School districts also received additional federal Title I dollars and special education dollars. So school districts did receive quite a bit of funding through the Recovery Act. Just highlighting some other transparency efforts that the department has underway, a children's resource pilot project. We recently released a report based on legislation that was passed in 2009, and it provides an overview of expenditures that are aimed at children 21 years of age and under. We also have our TAP project, our Transparency Accountability Project, and that provides the public with information about spending, who are the vendors that we're contracting with, and dollar amounts that are paid to those vendors. We also, you'll hear about the searchable database and SWIFT next with the next presentation. And so now, if there aren't any questions, I'd like to do a little overview for you of the website.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer, I assume you don't mind being interrupted for questions. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just had a question on, and I thought, I know you're going to go into SWIFT, but I'm looking forward to that. But on the page 7, the bottom slide, where jobs created are retained by category, from what I'm reading all of these lists here, it appears, though, these are government jobs. From what I'm seeing in here, this is the government sector jobs.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the jobs that are reported are from state agency awards that were made, and they may have been made out to local entities. So in the case of education, for example, those are made to public school districts and charter schools in the state.
Okay. What, was there any tracking of the private sector at all? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, that's okay.
Keep going. Okay. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Was there any tracking then of the private sector jobs?
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, it is not tracked specifically separately. What we could do is dig into particular areas, like transportation, for example, is the majority of their jobs are with vendors that they contract with for transportation projects. So that would be an example of a private sector.
Yeah, would that be maybe under the infrastructure?
That's correct.
Okay, I thought that might be one. Okay, looks like you have somebody else.
Yep. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to hear the question on jobs.
Say who you are for the tape.
I apologize for getting here late, but looking forward to the presentation.
Okay.
I'll just keep on going.
Okay.
Chair, just to follow on, I assume that, you know, health and human services, infrastructure, workforce, there are a lot of these, energy and the environment, there could be a lot of private sector jobs that are ultimately funded. It's just that these are the government programs through which the funds are passing. And some of it may end up in the private sector, some of it may end up with teachers or whatever. Is that the takeaway?
That's a very fair comment, Madam Chair.
Mr. Schell.
The jobs are being tallied up from vendors. And so, you know, while the dollars are initially coming from the federal government to state agencies, that's what we're really tracking. And ultimately, who spends those, what are the jobs that are created or retained, are predominantly in the public sector, but there are certainly non-public sector jobs that are vendors who are supplying materials, doing construction sites, that kind of thing as well. That would be included in our accounts, certainly to the vendors.
Chair, follow up. Do you, Mr. Showalter or Ms. Weber, do you include a multiplier of any kind in calculating this, or is it just direct funding? Or is there an assumption that we could make about a multiplier?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the guidance specifically requires recipients to count the hours worked that are paid for, and then that is divided into a full-time equivalent schedule for that particular employment area.
So, oh, go ahead.
And I'd add on, the federal government has had at times taken a look at that. I think it's the Council of Economic Advisors, and a possible indirect impact of stimulus dollars. States are in the business of reporting the direct impact.
Madam Chair, has there been any consensus, whether it's CBO or Council of Economic Advisors or anybody else? And I know, for example, I talked to Tom Simpson, and he said there may be a 2-to-1 multiplier on the state bonding bills. I wonder if there's any,
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not
Mr.
sure.
Mr. Stoll?
I don't really know. Okay. We could certainly check. But the Council of Economic Advisors, I think, was the group that was working with the Recovery Advisory Board.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, I carried the energy stimulus bill, and so I appreciate the real strong work that's happened across all the agencies on transparency and reporting. And it's been interesting to be on the sort of behind the curtain a little bit as some of these problems have gotten worked out. My understanding is that, as somebody at Department of Commerce described to me initially, that because it's a stimulus recovery bill, we wanted to get funds out as fast as possible, that in essence Congress made, in their infinite wisdom, made the choice to choose the least inefficient means of getting dollars out. Sometimes I think that choice wasn't fully made, that there may have been more efficient means. But so, for instance, in energy, I know that of the $202 million that we received, about, as of 3 weeks ago, 18 and a half or 19 million had been spent, as from the office of, from the director of the State Energy Office. So I guess my question is if that's emblematic across the board of kind of percentages, or whether we saw more because so much more was state stabilization in health and human services and education, whether we've seen the bulk of those public dollars go out. And it's the bids for transportation, infrastructure, and energy that the private dollars are going more slowly because of the RFP process and those other pieces.
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, they actually do have some specifications in the Act by which some of those infrastructure dollars have to be obligated. And Minnesota was recognized in the energy side as being number one in the nation for getting those funds obligated. It may not that they have not been spent yet, but they have actually obligated them through contracts or grants. Also, the transportation dollars, I believe their deadline is September of 2010. Any dollars that are not obligated will then be reallocated across the states. And in talking with our Department of Transportation, they fully expect to obligate all of those dollars.
Okay. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Somewhat related question. I'm just reading the text underneath your pie chart, and it's not entirely clear to me. It says that the jobs data is just for the quarter, and yet there's some references to award data being cumulative for the life of the award, and then total cumulative expenditures of $624 million. Can you get us apples and oranges here? And the overriding question, I guess, is if we've already expended $624 million, how much is left? Kind of what percentage of the total award are we looking at here?
Representative, Madam Chair, and Representative Downey, the reason that we have this footnote on this chart is that in our award data and in our expenditure data, we are including three significant federal awards that don't require jobs reporting. One is the FMAP dollars that are administered by the Department of Human Services, the unemployment insurance that is administered by DEED, and then the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So what we wanted to do was separate out the dollars that are subject to 1512 reporting and therefore have jobs reporting associated with them. And so that's what the footnote is representing, the expenditures that are subject to 1512 and have jobs reporting associated with it.
Madam Chair. So the jobs information is for a three-month span, but the total dollars expended is kind of life to date. Is that a fair statement?
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, that is correct. Initially, when the reporting requirements were developed, it was identified that all data elements would be cumulative, so you'd be able to look at things for the entire life of the award. What changed with the Office of Management and Budget's jobs guidance that they released in December was that they said now that the jobs data would just be quarterly. So it does complicate things when you're looking at things side by side.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just to piggyback on Representative Downey's question, so then can we assume if you go to page 2 in your overview slide where you talk about that there was 4.9 in awards and 2.5 in expenditures, and if you couple that with jobs created footnote, are we then to make the assumption that of the 2.5 that's been expended, approximately 1.9 billion would be in what we would call non-entitlement expenditures?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think you would call them entitlement expenditures. The AFMET or non. Holbrook, I'm sorry. The FMAP, the unemployment. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. So the FMAP, yes, 1.9 is reflective of FMAP, unemployment insurance, and the supplemental nutrition program.
Okay, and just a comment, and you're probably going to cringe when you hear this, but I mean, I think you guys have done a great job, and it'll, for those that haven't seen the site, the I'm sure they'll be impressed by what you're about to show them. But in a meeting a couple days ago, I think Representative Kahn was there as well, we thought that we should sign you guys up to do this same thing for the sales tax money program, the legacy funding, do a similar website so the expenditures and use and benefits of that pot of money could be tracked as well.
That was actually kind of going to be one of the things when we first heard the very preliminary meetings on this. One of the things, my question was, well, how long is it going to be? This is probably when they were still ranked 34th in the country. my question was, how long is it going to be before we put the whole budget on this? Can we expect that, you know, by the next biennium? And the answer we were given was that it wasn't as easy as we thought it was, but we kind of, didn't we kind of get a promise that maybe the bonding bill could be on this? Is that true or still true?
Madam Chair, I don't think there was a promise on the capital investment bill.
Okay.
I think in terms of the next place that's next easiest to get to, that's probably a somewhat logical one. You know, besides just having a great team working on the ARA project, making sure that we're setting up the data collection, we're setting up the guidance for state agencies, collecting the data, and then doing the transparency. Now, it also helped us that we knew what the categories were. But it also helped us a lot that we had a finite list of programs.
But and categories, bonding's really easy. It's just like buildings, land, and
RIM,
stuff.
For instance, or the statewide asset preservation, or HEPR. These are projects that really aren't so site specific. There may be possible locations underneath that you may even be thinking about, but for a mapping function, that may not be the way you want to go. On the other hand,
but
when you get to the state
budget, I guess
budget,
the point is, if we, I'm not sure that you would do it at the point of appropriation, but at the point of expenditure, it should be possible, shouldn't it?
Certainly.
Why is my memory that someone just said, oh, sure, the bonding bill?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, because that wasn't my reflection. and knowing the resources that the situation that got us to this point, we're very, very happy with this. And we also know it's a double-edged sword because success sometimes breeds higher expectations. And we've got, I think, a very interesting SWIFT project that's going to take a lot of attention. We've got a very interesting budget system project that's going to take a lot of attention. Occasionally, we talk about cash flow management, budget problems, rating agency issues. So amongst those things, we definitely are all about transparency. It's just a matter of making sure we can do it right.
Well, then following up on Representative Holbrook's suggestion, what about the legacy bill? The legacy funding.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's a great possibility. And I think we've learned some things. And certainly,
wait a minute.
Talk to anybody about our website and how we got there. And I think we want to keep on going down this transparency.
The people who
this
see
is where we need
us
to go.
of micromanaging, and I look at this federal thing of the 10th day and the 30th day and so forth. So what if we start putting those in our bill? I mean, you did it. The proof is that you did it.
Madam Chair, to that note, one of the things that you might remember, an amendment that Representative Hoppe and I offered and withdrew on the energy stimulus bill, where swimming pools were not allowed to be public swimming pools were not allowed to be targets of federal spending under the Coburn Amendment. But it turns out, under micromanagement mistakes, turns out that that's the greatest return on investment for any renewable energy project, and the greatest payback. So we should all be cautious about micromanagement.
That's because people are wimpy and want them warmer than they should be.
It's actually because of solar hot water is the fastest turnaround, like a year and a half payback. We could be doing all of our buildings and saving a lot of money, but no, we can't because of micromanagement.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could just also note appreciation, because, you know, kidding aside, I think one of the really positive things about this project has been sort of the legislative and executive branch discussions that have gone along the way. It's helped steer our interests and concerns. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we thought one set of concerns were going to be what you wanted, turned out to be something else. That helped orient us, and helped orient us a lot faster than we otherwise would have done. And, you know, appreciated the committee's help in securing some funding to make sure that this all happened. And it wasn't all specified exactly what was going to happen. It was more a experiment of working together and working forward on this project. Okay. And I think that was a very good model.
Yeah. Did we have any of the issues with the phantom counties and things like that? It was interesting, I guess, what I read about it, the reason those occurred is that people got a job and they had a questionnaire and they were supposed to put down their county. And I mean, their, either their county's name or their congressional district or something. Turns out that's something that people just put down numbers at random when asked for that.
Madam Chair, there were some reported in Minnesota. They were not state agency administered reports. They were entities that received funds directly from the federal government. And it might have been a contractor, for example, who lived in a different state. They reported the congressional district of their home office versus the congressional district where the work was occurring. The federal government put some controls in place with the second reporting quarter so that your zip code had to align with the appropriate congressional district.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I guess I have another question, which would be whether you could use some business intelligence software tools and make them available for anybody to do this.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, the tool that we used for the mapping, actually, we did get it was made available for us at a relatively inexpensive cost. I believe it may have been free. I'm looking over to David Arbeit at MnGeo. And so the cost that was associated was the staffing cost to convert the data into the format that it needed to be in to align with that software tool.
Madam Chair, this is kind of a new issue or a new interest area of mine, there is software, I mean, and this is a whole industry, that can actually just map to your chart of accounts and provide business intelligence tools that anybody could use, whether it's at the legislature, the public, the media, anybody, for a relatively modest cost. And you don't have to convert data, you don't have to go to open source, you don't have to do any of those things. You can basically, as long as you have database mapped, the technology can help produce these kinds of reports. And so we wouldn't have to put all the burden on your staff to do it. People could map it according to, or could draw out the data and use it according to their own interests.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's an interesting area. One of the things that we even explored after getting the map out, which we thought was a really interesting tool, really illustrative, but we also knew that it wasn't the kind of thing that, say, Ms. Roberts would use sometimes for looking at information on Recovery Act spending. And so some of the reports that we were starting to put together, you know, give a different way of getting that same information. Because mapping isn't the solution for all sets of data. Multi-query reports or drillable reports aren't the answer for all. But it's sort of choosing the right tool for the database that's there.
Anything else? Okay. Any closing words on this?
Madam Chair, I'll just point out a few highlights of the website quickly so that the SWIFT presentation can begin. This is the Recovery Min site, and as I mentioned, we do have on here the comprehensive database for those who want all of the data. If you click on here, you open up an Excel file that has all the data that was submitted to the federal government. We also have the interactive reports that I mentioned, which allow the user to search either by a state agency or by a category. The user might not know what particular state agency administers the program that they're interested in. So if you click on state agency and you're interested in looking at the Department of Human Services, for an example, you can then see all of the awards, all of the federal awards that they are administering. If you click on a particular award, you can then see who all of the subrecipients are that received those funds. So looking at the community services grant, for example, you'll then get to a report that lists out all of the subrecipients, a description of what they're doing, how much they were awarded, how much they've spent, and any jobs reporting that they've included.
And how are those updated? How often? Or
these interactive reports are updated quarterly to align with the federal update process. Then in looking at the map quickly, this is, as I mentioned, was developed in partnership with MnGeo. And what this allows the user to do is look at a map of Minnesota and see the allocation of funds. They can look by category. So if someone is interested in energy and environment, they can click on that category. It then shows in the pie chart the various energy and environment programs that are feeding into this category. I'll move this out of the way. This is currently allocated by county, so you can look at a particular county and see how much has been awarded to that county, how much has been paid out in that county. If you click on them, you can drill down to the individual program areas. So looking here at ERA Clean Diesel, you can then see who that England Trucking received an award. If you click on England Trucking, then you'll get an overview of their award, a description, how much they've been allocated, if they've been paid any dollars, and whether or not they reported any jobs. The map also has a search feature where you can plug in an address and a zip code to get information in a local area.
How about the categories? What are the categories? Do you got a choice that you have to pick?
Yep, the categories are, you can look at the overall stimulus spending, which is all of the categories combined together. You can review it by health and human services, education, transportation, energy and environment, housing, economic development, or public safety. By honing in, then, the star is reflective of the address that I entered in the system. And then I can click on here to show the individual projects, and it will then come up with push pins of projects that are in the area of that particular address that you entered in. I can go to the different categories and then get a load of, now I've clicked on transportation, so I can see here the different transportation projects in that are surrounding that area as well. So that is a very quick overview. It does have a lot of detailed information on the map, but due to time, I thought I'd just give you a quick review.
What are the other symbols like besides the environment?
We still have the white hat.
Yep, so we changed those.
Oh.
So for health and human services, we have this symbol, which will go, and let's go to the full view of the map. So this is the health and human services symbol. The symbols that we had when we initially released the map were based on symbols that were used in Colorado and Maryland, other states that were a little bit ahead of the game with us. And education, we changed it just to a graduation cap. And then public safety, we changed from, you may recall, the police officer. We changed it to the star.
So. And what happened to the white hat?
The white hat has become this symbol here, which I'm sure it has a name for it, but I am not.
Okay. I'd forgotten that. It was pretty good.
Yeah. And Representative Kahn, we did change the light bulb early on. We changed that after your comment to the leaf. So that was changed right away.
It was not a fluorescent incandescent. I went to the loop. Aren't you glad that somebody comes to all these meetings to keep them in shape? Okay. Now, any other questions on this? Okay, so you'll tell us how many things we can instruct you to apply this to in our final bill. Silence. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's really been impressive watching this, I think.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, on to SWIFT.
Madam Chair, members, hello. My name is Lori Moe, Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm here to give you an update on what we're now calling the SWIFT project. The project, as we talked about it last year, was referred to as the MAPS Replacement Project or the New MAPS Project. As we got underway, we decided that the new project and the new system would be better served by a new name so that we weren't 10 years from now still referring it to it as the new maps and the old maps. And
just so the committee understands that I always check these things out, the first thing I did was to check to see if that was really a decent representation of a SWIFT, and it was. And so.
Did we actually authorize the acronym and the bill?
No, but, you know, I was just concerned that they'd have...
We were doing renaming last year.
I know, but I was concerned that they might have something that wasn't really a SWIFT. I mean,
and Madam Chair...
I know we dealt with birds in the bill.
The acronym was arrived at following a contest with suggestions from across the state agencies, and the SWIFT acronym was suggested by an employee at the Department of Natural Resources. And the acronym stands for Statewide Integrated Financial Tools. Today I'll be talking to you about the scope of the project timeline, the accomplishments to date, as well as the current activities that are underway. As you remember from our discussions last year, the benefits of the new system will be to bring us to a stable, sustainable technical infrastructure with ongoing support and upgrades available from the vendor with off-the-shelf delivered software. We'll have improved reporting capabilities and greater efficiency and enhanced functionality, as well as improved tools. When we first started on the project, the goal was to replace the current functionality in the financial and procurement modules, as well as to update and improve our reporting capabilities. During the session last year, you'll remember that there was language passed for a searchable database for improved public transparency. While that was not included in our original RFP, we did add the system requirements and modified the functionality when we did contract negotiations with our vendor, and those requirements have now been incorporated and will be delivered along with the on the same timeline as the project as a whole. As we were doing an evaluation of the proposals we received, we ultimately selected the Oracle PeopleSoft product for our system software. That's the same vendor and the same software product that we have used for many years for our HR payroll and benefits administration system, the system that we call Semaphore. And with the selection of a common vendor, it provided some new opportunities to look at how we're delivering our data warehouse solution. We are now able to take a vendor-delivered solution for our data warehouse rather than developing our own warehouse to aggregate data from multiple systems. By selecting the common vendor, we also will have a common portal for entry into the systems, as well as common security. The next slide is the overall project timeline. starting in the summer of 09. As you may remember, we actually started the early planning phases of the project in advance of these dates and published our RFP and began the evaluation and selection process back in, the RFP was published in January, and the value, as soon as the decision was made that the project would be included in the governor's budget recommendations. And we conducted the evaluation and selection process concurrent with the legislative session last year. And so we were positioned to make a contract award and begin contract negotiations shortly after the funding decisions were reached at the end of session last year. As a result, we were able to begin work with the vendor on site in August of 09, far ahead of where we would have been if we had waited for end of session due to the complexity of the procurement process. And so we've been in the planning phase and moving into the design phase since early fall, and the it continues through this spring. The development phase will begin in the spring and continue through April of 2011. And the spring of 2011 will focus primarily on testing activities as well as training for agency users. The go live target remains at July 1st of 2011. This timeline is currently featured on the homepage of our project website, and you'll be able to refer to it there for where it'll be regularly updated along with other information. And the website link is provided on this next slide, where I'll talk about some of the accomplishments that have happened since we've gotten underway. As I mentioned, we had complex procurement process and as well as contract negotiations, which we completed in August. We organized the state vendor and agency subject matter expert teams. We established the governance structure for the project, including agency representation. We've got a project team of that will be over 100 people at peak, and agency subject matter experts that are participating on a part-time basis in the 170 plus range. So we've got a great deal of participation across state government, and one of our chief methods of communicating with that group is through the project website that you see here. I'm not going to go through a demo of the website today, but this is the home page. You can see on the left side there's some general project information. We're updating frequently asked questions regularly. There's documentation about the project, details on the governance structure, scope and module information. And then on the right side, we have some news items. We have an activity calendar for regularly updated. And we have a growing area of information for what we're calling enterprise readiness, for agencies to get information about the tasks that they should be focusing on, the things that they need to do to be prepared for the project. The readiness effort in the project is a major part of the undertaking. We have already identified project sponsors and managers or coordinators at all of the state agencies. We've assigned a project readiness manager to work with each agency and will be monitoring and managing their preparedness activities throughout the life of the project. We've also recently launched a job task survey, which is a detailed survey about the current job activities of all of the current users of the MAP system. It will be used for designing the training effort for the SWIFT project. And we're also very close to releasing an agency implementation assignment calendar, which will go through the life of...
Madam Chair, can I interrupt?
Yeah. Okay. Representative Winkle.
Ms. Moe, could you just, the job task survey, you mentioned that it's for purposes of designing training.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that what you're doing is getting more detailed information about how people interact with the system rather than kind of the overview. Because I guess what I'm wondering is, I think you did this, if I remember right, you did something similar for the design of the system, a significant statewide or agency, multi-agency effort to better understand how agencies are actually using MAPS or would like to use it.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we had earlier in the project we had done a detailed run through of the system requirements, and we had done documentation of current business processes. This task that's currently underway is going down to the individual employee level and looking at not just which modules, for example, that they use in their current job assignments, but down to specific tasks, so that we'll not only be able to design the training that will fit best for them, but have understanding of the numbers of people in each of the various training tracks that will be developed for everything from scheduling and room assignments, instructor assignments, to materials preparation.
Madam Chair, Ms. Moe, will that include legislative staff as well as, I mean, other, more than just agency staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, all of the current MAPS as well as warehouse users were included in the survey distribution.
I guess, is that a yes?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I could just, okay. I actually did fill out the job task survey for the House fiscal staff right now. I think fiscal staff are the only ones that use the warehouse. And
okay. Now, one of the things that we've required for all these projects like this is the risk assessment and mitigation. So what's, how has that worked out on this project?
Madam Chairman, for a project of this size, the requirement is to complete a risk assessment before 10% of the funding is expended. And we did very early on contract for risk assessment services and completed that early in the fall. With the 10% threshold, it means in a project of this type that it needs to be completed very early in the project. Because the software purchase alone is close to that threshold. So we had that completed this fall. It was because we were so early in the project, it primarily looked at our planning activities and also pointed out the some of the risks that are inherent in a project of this size and complexity. But it did bring all of those things onto our radar. For the most part, they were already. And we also got some good reinforcement of our underlying principles to try and keep this system as vanilla as possible, that is to use the delivered version of the software rather than to modify it highly, because that adds risk and cost and complexity to any project.
What was there any problem? I remember I was the person who put this language in statute, so was there any problem with the requirement to contract with an entity outside of state government and to make sure that it was something that had no interest in, that the group doing the risk assessment would only have interest in doing that and would have no ability to benefit from the project? Was that any kind of a problem in doing something of this complexity?
Madam Chairman, no, that wasn't a problem for us. We were able to find an experienced vendor through one of the master contracts that's been established through the Department of Administration and Enterprise Technology. So we didn't have to do the formal RFP process. There was already a contract in place, so we published a statement of work. And that's a good thing. It would have delayed things if we'd had to do an RFP because of the 10% threshold requirement.
Is PeopleSoft are they in other states, and have they done other projects in this state besides that?
Madam Chair, PeopleSoft is currently owned by Oracle. It is the product that we're using is used worldwide. It's used by a number of other states. And as I mentioned, we've been using it here since the middle 90s for our semaphore system, for our HR payroll benefits administration system. And they provide regular updates as well as version upgrades for the product.
What about the issue with Maximus?
Madam Chair, Maximus is our implementation vendor, so they are the vendor that is on site in Minnesota working with us to install the product. And I expect the issue that you're asking about is their announcement that they plan to sell off their ERP practice. That announcement was made, I believe it was in November, mid-November. We have, other than the formal notice that was made at that time, we have not gotten a great deal of additional information because of SEC limitations on discussing the sale. But our commissioner did speak with their CEO shortly after the announcement, and we are doing and we'll do our due diligence when a buyer is announced to ensure that they have the qualifications to manage a project of this size. We do have language in our contract with Maximus that requires that we approve the assignment of the contract, and so we will be doing everything we can to protect ourselves in that scenario. The Commissioner Hansen was assured by the CEO that they intended to look only at large qualified vendors that are in this business and have experience with ERP implementation. So we're waiting for more information.
Have any of these ever worked with a state that has as many separate data centers as the state does?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. We will be operating this system on hardware located at the Office of Enterprise Technology.
Are there any other?
Madam Chair, I just thought of another question. You mentioned that we're moving, or that you've selected Oracle PeopleSoft because it matches the existing HR system. No?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, if that's what I said, I didn't mean to give you that impression. We did an RFP and did an evaluation of the software, not intending or expecting to go that direction. But the implementation vendors that proposed the software concluded that was the best fit for the 4,000 plus requirements that we had included in our RFP. The benefits of of having the option to do a common warehouse, common portal, and common security are a result of that, but we didn't go to that software because of those reasons. And there was not points associated with those benefits in our evaluation process.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Mo. That important distinction. I guess I wasn't too worried about it. But one of the questions that it creates for me is that an advantage of rolling out a whole new system like this could be in making data sets more standardized so that you can more easily compare and you use and that people will use the system more, in a more homogenous way. So the better training, better use, and you're getting rid of maybe old habits that make use of codes and classifications and so forth difficult to follow. And I guess the question that leads me to is, does the Oracle PeopleSoft on the HR side allow us to, or how good a job do we do of making more of a standardized use? Or are we describing employee positions the same way across agencies, for example? And does that get rolled up into the system? Or does each agency use that system in its own unique way? And are we missing an opportunity there?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we do have many statewide policies and procedures associated with HR, payroll, and benefits administration that are managed with that Semaphore system. The degree of flexibility within job descriptions, for example, I can't address, but certainly we're quite standardized in the area of payroll. We have a common pay cycle, use the same account structure overall, and now with the addition of the new modules, we'll have the delivered integration points between payroll and financials. So I don't know if I answered your question. There may be additional opportunities there. We have focused a lot of energy in recent years on becoming more vanilla in that system, reducing the system modifications, and I think every time that we do system upgrades, we'll continue to look at that and make progress. And that becomes easier to do as the product is enhanced as delivered by the vendor.
Were there any things that were in separate agencies and totally separate in the old MAPS system that are now being brought into this system in a more integrated fashion, or was everything taken care of in the old MAPS system?
Madam Chair, there are a number of standalone agency systems that we believe will be addressed by the functionality in the new system. We're in the process of identifying where all of those systems are located through some of our survey work, some of our inventories of conversion and interface needs by agencies. But they're primarily in the areas where the new system provides significantly enhanced functionality. Accounts receivable is a good example. We had accounts receivable functionality in MAPS, but it was not particularly robust and it didn't meet the needs at a number of agencies, and so they had developed their own systems, and we believe those needs will be met through the SWIFT system, and we'll be able to convert a number of those. And we're just going through a process now of, as I said, identifying those, and we'll have a rigorous review process for any system that is not scheduled for conversion.
Representative Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we're kind of diving into maybe your next slide. I've been holding a couple questions, but we're kind of touching on this issue. And so my question, I remember being concerned about this at the beginning when you were describing the effort undertaken prior to the procurement, that we hadn't really done kind of the departmental analysis and the business process analysis to know where we would get standardization and commonality and where we would be able to bring everybody together. And your comments seem to confirm that. And then your this fit gap section in your next slide, that 4,000 of your requirements are only 2,400, 2,500 are actually met. So are we just uncovering a lot of things that we didn't think about during the selection, kind of the pre-selection analysis phase? Are we going to have stray departments using non-SWIFT functionality all over the place and customized business processes department to department, or are we really going to have a common statewide platform for all of these business functions?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I'll address the fit gap analysis that you asked about. The 4,000 requirements, we knew when we went through the evaluation phase of our procurement process that the software were not going to be fully met. The software would not fully meet the state's requirements as published in the RFP. So as we evaluated the software, we learned that there were numerous ways of addressing those requirements. In some cases, that's going to mean there are multiple configuration options within the software as different ways to meet the state's needs. But in many cases, it will mean business process redesign to incorporate the best practices and the business processes that are built into the software. And so what we're doing through our fit gap process is deciding on solutions for each of those requirements where it did not clearly meet the requirement as written. But we will be looking for common solutions that will be used statewide, and we will be looking at system modifications only as a last resort. We're doing that analysis through what we're calling approach papers, and there'll be about 350 approach papers developed. They will, in each approach paper will address a number of the requirements where we have gaps. We're about a quarter of the way through those now, and to date we're looking at system modifications that are actually less than what we had projected when we did the software selection. So we've still got a long way to go on the approach papers, but we're considering all of those options. And I think in your packet you should have a copy of one of the approach papers. And it wasn't that I was going to talk about the specifics of the paper, but it gives you some information on what we are looking at as we develop those. And as we develop solutions, this is one of the places where we're involving the subject matter expert group to talk about alternative approaches to issues and identify solutions that will meet agency needs, but also use the delivered functionality of the software.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a follow-up. So are there a bunch of agencies that will still use, for example, I'm just looking at this one approach document, and it talks about an accounts payable interface, which is maybe one of the most standardized finance functions there is. I mean, are there departments that won't be moving on to SWIFT for some basic accounting functions? Maybe we could just get, maybe I'm overstating this, if we could just get a list of all the agencies that for whatever reason think they can't go on the standard system for certain functions?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, all of the agencies will be using SWIFT. The accounts payable interface that's referenced in this document refers to some of the interfaces we currently have with major subsystems, program-specific subsystems at various agencies. For example, at Human Services, the Medicaid Management Information System is a huge complex system on its own that manages the claim processing and payments to Medicaid providers for services to individual recipients. We don't, in the SWIFT system, capture that level of detail, nor did we ever intend to, but we have to replicate that that interface process, because although that system does processing for all of those claims, the payments that are made will still come out of the SWIFT system, and the accounting for that will, at a summary level, will still be in the SWIFT system.
Madam Chair, so just let me make a statement, and you tell me if I'm wrong. But so every state agency for all of these functional areas in accounting and procurement will be on the new SWIFT system, and they will all be running standardized processes and kind of data sets, as Representative Winkler described.
They will all be, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, they will all be on the SWIFT system. As I said, some of them have some standalone systems currently, like receivables and inventory, that we expect to be replaced by the SWIFT system. We have not completed that analysis. I can't tell you today that there won't be some out there that will, for whatever reason, make a case to stay off. But we do plan to do a rigorous review of all of those systems.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
All right. As I mentioned, we also are about to release an agency implementation assignment calendar that will aid agencies in understanding the activities that will be coming up over the next 18 months to prepare for the go-live date. We'll be updating that every quarter with additional detail about the activities that are coming up that quarter. This will be things from data gathering assignments, interfaces, reports, data conversion, testing activities, as well as the training that I already mentioned. We do expect to have agency subject matter experts involved in the testing towards the end of the project, and believe that will help in their readiness for go live, as well as the training efforts. As you know, the data warehouse is the data repository that we use for much of the state's ad hoc reporting needs. As I mentioned, we'll be using a delivered product provided by the vendor, and we're in the process now of doing the design work on that module as well. We've also been working with the vendor to do the analysis of the integration points with the Semaphore system, the HR payroll system, and that design work has also begun. I've talked about the FitGap sessions and the approach papers. Pretty much wraps up my comments. The FitGap sessions are going to predominate the activities in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And there are also a number of activities underway in the readiness area, as well as in the technical area, preparing the environments for the development phase that will begin once design is completed.
How is this going to work with the new budget system? And what's the progress on the new budget system?
Madam Chair, I believe Mr. Showalter just stepped out of the room. I think there is full intention to integrate that product with the SWIFT system, but the current timelines for the budget system are such that we will be doing some of that integration work after the go-live date of the SWIFT system rather than in advance of the SWIFT system. We've had numerous discussions about which project comes first and what follows what, and we expect that will be designed to be compatible with the new system rather than the current accounting.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much. I'll point out to members that in your packet you have this thing on the risk assessment management. You can take home and study thoroughly. And thank you very much. We are probably, we don't have anything on our schedule yet for Thursday. We're looking at a couple of things, so keep tuned. We'll probably have a meeting. But. Okay, thank you. Meeting adjourned. Okay.